Hi, everyone. Welcome to the new Retina Radio Journal Club with VBS. My name is Shruthi Arapalli from the Emory Eye Center in Atlanta. Today, I'm joined by Videhi Dadania from NYU Langone in New York City.
Hi, thank you for having me.
And Rebecca Soares from the Ophthalmic Consultants of Boston.
Great to be here. Thanks so much.
And today, we're discussing the comparison of endophthalmitis rates following alcohol-based chlorhexidine and povidone iodine antisepsis for intravitreal injections by Dr. Mishra et al., which was published in Ophthalmology Retina recently in August 2023. Rebecca, would you mind summarizing this paper for us?
So this is a retrospective cohort study of patient records from Alberta Retina Consultants over a three-year period from May of 2019 to October of 2022. It compared the rates of endophthalmitis in patients treated with intravitreal injections who received povidone iodine, which is the standard of care, and chlorhexidine, which was they considered a possible povidone iodine alternative. Interestingly, the way that they applied the povidone iodine was a 10% swab to the conjunctiva, and then the chlorhexidine was a 0.05% solution with a 4% alcohol base, again applied with a cotton swab. They considered over 170,000 intravitreal injections, with about 82% of the injections done with the povidone iodine and about 16% of the injections done with the chlorhexidine. In terms of their findings, their overall endophthalmitis rate was 0.029%. Patients receiving chlorhexidine were three times more likely to develop endophthalmitis compared to those treated with traditional povidone iodine. There were 29 patients who had endophthalmitis in the povidone iodine group and 20 patients in the chlorhexidine group. There was also surprisingly an increased odds, 3.48 times, of developing endophthalmitis in patients who received aflibercept compared to those who received bevacizumab. The authors conclude primarily that alcohol-based chlorhexidine should be considered a second-line treatment because of the higher rates of endophthalmitis compared to those patients treated with povidone iodine in their study.
That was really fantastic. Before we head into our break, Videhi, would you mind giving us your reactions to this paper? So we talk about the rates of endophthalmitis. Are these in line with what you've seen in your practice? And maybe you could just walk us through your gold standard for injections and what you do for antisepsis.
Yeah, so yes, these rates are in line with what I see. You know, many studies have demonstrated a wide range, although still a very small overall risk, as does this study here. And you do have a variation in the numbers between both groups. In the povidone iodine group, you have 140,000 patients. And in the chlorhexidine group, you only have 30,000 patients. Yes, those are both very large numbers, but many of these studies that have been performed are all retrospective. And so, you know, the data always needs to be taken with a grain of salt. But yes, both of these numbers fall in line with what we tend to see in our practice. Regarding my gold standard, so my gold standard is povidone iodine and 5%. It's always a drop of 5%. And what I always teach the residents and fellows is the last thing to touch the conjunctiva is povidone iodine. And what I mean by that is I will give the patient a drop of 5% in the fornix. I will turn around and, you know, it takes probably about 30 seconds to open the box of whatever medication I'm giving, take off the cap, put on the needle, take out what I need to. By that time, 30 seconds is over. I turn back over to the patient. I hold their eyelids and then I give one more drop. And so that's what I mean by the last thing that touches the conjunctiva is the povidone iodine. There's no eyelid. There's nothing else that's touching the conj there. And I ensure that it's been there for at least 30 seconds, if not longer.
I think that's great. Rebecca, do you have any last minute thoughts before we head into our break?
No, I think, I totally agree. I think it's, that is my gold standard as well. Interestingly, and we can talk about this a little bit after the break, but I inherited a practice where the provider was doing actually a majority of chlorhexidine. So that was an interesting transition for me and for a lot of the patients. And so we can talk about that a little bit as well. But typically, I prefer to start with povidone iodine if possible, if the patient will tolerate it. And I use the same technique, it sounds like, as you.
Is that the 5%?
5%, correct. 5% and not on a swab, just, you know, all over, you know, conge, a drop. And then I try to make that the last thing that hits the patient's eye before the injection itself.
That's perfect. All right, well, now we're going to head into our break. And when we return, we'll have a more in-depth discussion on this paper and our practice patterns.
Support for this program is brought to you by Genentech, the makers of Vabysmo, faricimab SVOA. There's more to explore. Discover all the data at vabysmo-hcp.com. That's vabysmo-hcp.com.
Hi, everyone. Welcome back to the new Retina Radio Journal Club with VBS. Now we're going to head into a longer discussion on this paper looking at antisepsis techniques for injections. So, Rebecca, I was going to start off with you. We talked a little bit in the first section about patients tolerating or not tolerating povidone iodine and how you've inherited a large number of patients who use or prefer chlorhexidine. What do you do when a patient states that they've got an allergy or a true intolerance to povidone iodine? Do you talk to them about it and then just wash them out really well? Do you switch to chlorhexidine? Do you do antibiotic drops? What's your preferred method?
Yeah, so I think I ran into trouble in the beginning because I prefer to use betadine in everyone. And so initially when I inherited this practice from a previous physician who used chlorhexidine, I would say in more than 75% of his patients. Initially, I tried to switch a lot of them back to betadine, but unfortunately, a lot of them still were fairly intolerant to the betadine. And so I ended up using chlorhexidine. So now I use a lot more chlorhexidine than I ever thought I would. I think my biggest problem with the chlorhexidine, they sort of mentioned this in the article, a lot of his patients also require lidocaine. And I do all my lidocaine injections superiorly. And what's hard about the chlorhexidine is that I feel like it's hard to know whether or not you've gotten the antisepsis in the appropriate spot when you have the patients look down, because people try to bells a lot. And so I often worry that I'm not quite reaching the same spot with the chlorhexidine that I will be with the injection. So it takes me a little bit longer to ensure that I've actually gotten the chlorhexidine where it needs to go superiorly. And they sort of address that in the paper where, you know, they actually use a cotton swab with chlorhexidine and sort of roll it on the conge. To me, that would make me very nervous because it's invisible. You can't see where with the, you know, a 10% betadine, you can have someone hold the eyelids and, you know, carefully apply the cotton swab and, you know where you've gone to know where to direct your injection. But to just do that with a cotton swab of chlorhexidine feels a little bit like you're going to lose your spot and sort of miss the chlorhexidine altogether. So I think that's one of my biggest problems with using the chlorhexidine. Ideally, in patients who I have started on injections myself, I will use betadine. And then in patients who seem to be very sensitive to it, I actually recommend that they bring with them a bottle of artificial tears, and we start immediately on a protocol of like every 30 minutes, you're putting in a drop of artificial tear after you go home for like the next few hours. And that has actually helped stem a lot of the irritation. And it also sort of gives the patient the expectation that it's normal to have irritation. You know, it sort of stops them from calling in because they know to expect it and they sort of take it into their own hands. So they sort of feel like, okay, well, I can sort of handle this myself. So that has helped a lot. But yeah, it's an interesting issue.
That's a really great recap of your practice patterns. Videhi, do you have anything to add? What do you like to do?
So I actually only exclusively use povidone iodine 5%. In patients that have particular irritation afterwards, I will, you know, be a little bit more attentive to when I wash it out. I may be a little bit more attentive depending upon what I'm injecting and if it's prepackaged versus something else, about really only keeping it there for 30 seconds and not much longer. You know, I've had a handful of patients, not really like it, but I and request something else or request nothing. And I explained to them that there really isn't an allergy. So a lot of patients will say, you know, they have an allergy, and explain it's not an allergy. You know, in our literature, a betadine allergy is very rarely reported in its true form. And so I explain that. And if it's pre-surgery, for example, I have, and they really are insistent, I will actually have them go get tested so that they can see themselves it's not an allergy. It's just an expected occurrence with this sort of antiseptic method. So I have not used chlorhexidine or another agent since. I do have one patient who insists on only one drop of betadine. So for her, some things, a dude like her lid will touch her conge before my injection. And she also insists it not be washed out, which is interesting, but she says it's a lot less irritating for her.
That's really interesting to hear. But I'm glad to hear that you kind of remind patients that an allergy is very rare, because I think that's a common thing that we hear about and have to struggle with. I had a mentor in fellowship who said that you could do, you know, three rounds of Vigamox or some sort of antibiotic drop, and that would give you the same effect as povidone iodine. And I think there's probably a lot of truth to that. But if you're doing three rounds of drops 5 minutes apart, that can quickly add up. And so I haven't really introduced that into my clinic pattern either, because I'll quickly become landlocked, I think. If I offer this to more than one patient. And then this paper also brings up an interesting point that I wanted to bounce off the both of you, is the authors talk about how they had the same technique pre-pandemic, and then post-pandemic people wearing masks. And now that we're sort of a couple of years past our initial hit of the pandemic, I wanted to ask the both of you, and Vedehi, we can start with you. Are people still masking in your clinics, what your protocols are? And do you take any special precautions in regards to endophthalmitis with these patients?
So I will say maybe 25% to a third of patients are masking in my clinic. I don't generally mask unless there's another reason to. So in that regard, it's changed since during the pandemic, and even pre-pandemic, none of the patients were masking. In regards to my injection, I always ask patients whether they are masked or not. I will, before the needle cap comes up, I'll say, all right, let's pause for a second. We're not going to talk for a moment. Neither of us talks. I've already asked them to look up, and I go ahead and do the injection. And, you know, as we know, studies have shown that masking, at least in the traditional form, hasn't necessarily changed endophthalmitis risk. So that's why I feel comfortable not masking myself.
And Rebecca?
Yeah, I don't necessarily mask. I adhere to the no talking rule as much as possible. There was a paper that came out, and I have to look more into this, but there was a paper that came out that looked at taping a patient's mask. And to me, that makes a lot of sense to me. Just, you know, wearing a mask yourself, you know, you're breathing into your mask, it's sort of jet streaming right into your eyes or into your glasses and fogging you up. So to me, it might be a little bit of voodoo, but based on that one paper, I sort of started taping the top of masks, and I feel that doesn't add too much time to clinic. It also just makes me feel safer, or I have the patient, if they feel comfortable, take down their mask. Other than that, I don't necessarily adhere to wearing a mask myself. I think what's interesting about this paper, and one thing I was wondering, is whether or not they consistently used chlorhexidine throughout the entire time during the COVID, you know, throughout the entire time of when the study was performed. Because if chlorhexidine was like a more recent addition to their clinical practice, you also wonder if there's differing endophthalmitis rates, because maybe they were also using more chlorhexidine and people were masking more and having, you know, more endophthalmitis because they weren't taping them. You know, there's lots of variables to be considered here. So I thought it was a really interesting study, and definitely huge numbers, and probably we never will have a randomized control trial just because of the like pure number needed to treat to find endophthalmitis. But, you know, I thought it was a great paper to start looking at some of these little voodoos that we, you know, these little tricks that we all try that we all differ from a little bit, you know.
Yeah, and that's an amazing point, actually, about the timeline of when they rolled this out. But anyway, I want to thank both of you for your really great points. And this concludes our new Retina Radio Journal Club with VBS. Thanks again to our audience for tuning in and our panelists for their insightful discussion. And audience, please stay tuned for further episodes.